listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, we talk about different things in our interconnected world that affect us and our health, the health of humans and other species, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the ecological stability and balance of our habitat, planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk to different thought leaders, experts, filmmakers, advocates, scientists, authors, poets, all kinds of different people who are impassioned and informing us and expert in different among the many interconnected arenas that all come together to create life here on our wonderful living systems planet.
Yes, he is Dan Kittredge, the executive director and lead of the Bionutrient Food Association, and also the founder of it. He was raised by parents who are prominent leaders in the organic food movement. Has been an organic farmer since childhood. His experience managing organic farms and developing sustainable agricultural techniques has connected him to farmers all across the world and all across the country. And regular listeners to the show will recognize that we have been talking a lot over the recent weeks and months about the food supply, the healthfulness of it, the health of it, the way that it is intimately interconnected with the well-being and sustainability of our home, planet Earth. And this show is part of that series of closer looks we've been given to how our understanding of food begins with our own health, the health of our families, and healthy food choices. But that goes on. It really connects to the health of the earth, the health of our society, and the health of all people and species. And Dan is doing some tremendous, very innovative, and very much needed projects, which he'll be sharing with us on today's show. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Dan Kittredge.
Thank you very much.
So, you know, Dan, we're speaking just as we come out of something we were reporting on in this show for over the past 2 months in several different of the programs, and that is the now passed vote by the National Organic Standards Board of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, and it is this board that when we say if food is organic or something is organic, it's really this board that determines what we mean when we call something organic and something carries the organic label. A lot of people, as I've discovered in reporting on this, because, you know, I get all of hundreds of comments, people are interacting and sharing their views with me, all sides of these questions about the food supply. Organic can be a kind of general term. If you, you know, aren't really focused on it and getting down into the specifics, you kind of don't, you know, a lot of people don't really understand what it means or what is behind the label and the importance of that for determining the quality and integrity of our food. And recently, you know, our kind of naive belief that set up these organic standards, they're going to go on, you know, in time, and, you know, just be there and the food that, you know, that we think we mean when we say we're buying something organic will, in fact, meet what our expectations are. And in the past couple of weeks, 2 weeks, we've had a vote by the National Organic Standards Board, which substantively changes that. Do you want to orient our listeners a bit to, you know, your view of what this recent vote that occurred there just at the beginning of November means for the food supply and healthful eating?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll step back a little bit to my personal experience. Like you said in your introduction, I grew up on an organic farm in Massachusetts, and my parents have been, you know, critically involved in an organization called NOFA, Northeast Organic Farming Association, since the you know, early mid 80s. My father helped write some of the first organic standards in the country in the mid 80s. You know, I've been watching this process of organic since childhood. I remember in, I think it was third or fourth grade, telling my science teacher that I was an organic farmer, and she said, you know, organic beans contains carbon. All farmers are organic farmers, you silly child. It was, you know, I felt ridiculed, you know. But at some point in junior high or high school, you know, all of a sudden the 100th monkey had hit, the collective consciousness knew what this new word meant. And shortly thereafter, the National Organic Program was written by the you know, Congress, and the NOSB came in a few years after that. And, you know, the government formally took over the word organic from the grassroots movement. So I've been watching this evolution of the term, of the concept, of the community, of the impulse for some time, and certainly have seen it, you know, in my lifetime, move from a real grassroots, back to the land, you know, countercultural impulse to something that seems to be, you know, controlled at least relatively significantly by industry. And so I think the most recent vote allowing hydroponics in, you know, as organic, which basically, you know, says that we don't need to have crops grown in soil, is part of that trajectory. Certainly, you know, I mean, talking to my father, who helped write the standards in the 80s, about the decisions that were made, I have been asking this question about quality versus process. And effectively, the organic standard is a process standard. As long as the producers, you know, follow a certain set of protocols, something can be labeled organic, which does not necessarily correlate with, you know, inherent nutritional value or ecosystem beneficial effects. So, you know, to a large degree, we can say with great confidence that organic food is, you know, does not have toxins applied, that basically synthetic materials, synthetic fertilizer, synthetic, you know, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, et cetera. But it does not necessarily say that the soil was vital and vibrant when the crop was grown, the nutritive value is high, the flavor is high, et cetera. So, there's been a real creative tension between the grassroots and sort of industry for the last 20 years, really. I think a lot of the grassroots people, the farmers, as it were, are feeling, you know, ever more frustrated with the status of things. And so there's a deep conversation, you know, occurring right now about standards and certification and marketing and labels and what it is that we're actually doing and what it is that we're actually wanting to achieve. And so, I mean, we can segue now or later into the work that our organization is doing on that front with quality, and sort of our position is that it's the quality of the food that matters. Would that correlates directly? By quality, we're talking about flavor and aroma, nutritive value. That high quality correlates with carbon sequestration in the soil and, you know, health-giving attributes for the animals that eat it, be they humans or chickens. It's a process. It's a process, and as the biodynamic community would say, it's a really good way of envisioning it. There's a real bubbling up, a sort of more and more understanding in the movement about where things stand, and a really great conversation about where we should go forward from here, which is part of what we're hoping to have occur at our conference coming up in 2 weeks in Southbridge.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll definitely be telling our listeners more about that. You know, what you're talking about is that it's not that the outcome, the healthy outcome, the outcome that's healthy for people, the health outcome that's healthy for the environment, is the same outcome, but it's an outcome that comes about, in other words, having a nutrient-rich source of, you know, foods that taste delicious, that contain vital nutrients and minerals, that really nourish us, and that don't convey many of the contaminants and toxins. That's really a process of which the food is the outcome. And so if you're involved, like many things, if you're involved in the right process, then, you know, that is what you're creating. That's what you're supporting. From the consumer standpoint, there's long been this message of vote with your dollars, you know, your choices as a consumer to buy healthy food, you know, have power. You can support local CSAs. You can support local co-ops. You can support farmers and organic growers and, you know, restaurants that serve organic and sustainable food, you know, through your food choices, voting through your dollar. But what has happened over the 20 years, you know, that you and your family have been involved in, we've had these standards, is that there has been an astronomical growth of the organic food industry. It's one of the largest, you know, it has more growth in that sector than in the rest of the food supply where people are cutting turns back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet people thought that gave us a security. Hey, we voted with our dollars. This is the food we want. And instead, companies have come in and, you know, product companies of various kinds have come in, gotten a voice in the standards, kind of weighed in, and tilted the playing field in a way that was unanticipated. You know, so that's kind of a wake-up.
It was entirely mm-hmm. anticipated. We knew this was going to happen mm-hmm. when we saw the, you know, the structure. We knew this was a fait accompli in the mid-90s.
No kidding.
It was obvious. I mean, Elliot Coleman gave a speech, I'm not sure which year it was, at the NOFA Summer Conference, and he said, okay, people know what the word organic means now. Time for the next step. We've got to keep moving forward. you know, it's going to be co-opted, and let's keep the ball moving forward. Let's take that impulse, and let's keep the ball moving forward. The real point I'd like to make here about organic is, you know, it is certainly less bad, but it is not necessarily more good. And that's the, you know, that's the conclusion from the Stanford study of studies. You know, meta information is, you know, commercially what's available that has the organic label on it is yes, less toxic, but it is not necessarily more nutritious. And that's really what people, I think, are looking for, what their children need, but what we all need. We are what we eat. You know, you functionally get a new body every 6 months, and what the caliber is of the nutrition that you're putting into your body is the caliber of your whole being to a really interesting degree. And really, it's the same, you know, with the earth. The way we treat the earth has to do with her vitality and health. And we have such a direct connection with our food dollars to our health and the earth's health. And really keeping that conversation moving forward is where we're at. Yeah.
What does moving forward look like? You know, from your perspective. Now, you know, there's been this thing, the label from the, you know, perspective of a distant consumer, the label is no longer signifying what it once did. We don't know if, you know, necessarily, unless we pay very close attention and ask questions, whether, in fact, the food that we might be purchasing is like a kind of what I consider a hollow organic. In other words, it's hydroponically grown in an industry-like setting. It resembles the plant in question. It's been fed some nutrients that would be like a human being living on supplements, you know, or energy bars or something rather than real food.
IV drip, I call it. Yes, it's an IV drip. Hydroponics is basically a soluble nutrient solution. It's an IV drip.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's like that can't be a comparable. And, this, you know, again, it's been the subject of several shows that listeners can check out in the Connected Dots archives with Dave Chapman, with Fred Kirschman, as well as some recent blogs that I've done on Alternate EcoWatch and Truth Out on this topic. And you know, we kind of dive into it in greater depth about, you know, what the soil gives food and gives us and what the living interaction is between all of these life source fundamentals, really. So, you know, we've had this, you know, kind of wake-up call. Fortunately, the organic farmers who launched this whole thing and who have held that commitment over several generations were ahead of the curve on, you know, understanding that it would eventually go here. So what is the next phase? What does moving forward look like?
Well, for us, it looks like a deep, open collaboration across the broad movement. We see the incentives from the community that's focused on, you know, the climate change, carbon sequestration, you know, ecological health, running through the broad food movement, the permaculturalists, the locavores, the organic people, the organic people, sustainable ag, you know, permaculture, agroforestry, globally, all the way through to the human health, you know, component, the, you know, human nutrition. You know, it's such a broad suite of agendas, constituents, allies. And we see, you know, working collaboratively around the nutritional value of food as sort of the high ground upon which we can all, you know, coalesce. And so what our organization is working on, as I mentioned before, our organizational, you know, mission, the Bionutrient Food Association, is increasing quality in the food supply. We think through increasing quality in the food supply, we can solve really systemically a number of major apparently intransigent issues, you know, climate change, degenerative disease, you know, food. It just, it's really quite exciting. So for us, you know, at the real nub of it, it's giving consumers the ability to test quality at point of purchase. So, you know, I mean, I'm thinking in 5 years we'll have, you know, some smartphones will have the capacity to basically flash a light at a carrot or, you know, cheese or an apple and determine, okay, you got three bags of carrots to choose from. This one over here is 15 out of 100. This one over here is 40 out of 100. This one here is 80 out of 100. We can literally tell which of the foods available to us is most nutritious and purchase that accordingly. So, you know, right now we are about to launch, you know, again at our conference in 2 weeks, the first generation of a standalone handheld spectrometer, which is, you know, about the size of a smartphone. We're having a crowdfunding campaign. We're sort of launching this tool. We'll have it available for anybody who wants to be part of the development process next year, 2018. And we think, you know, the consumer tool will be available in 2 years, you know, standalone, and then it'll start to be, the hardware will be in the smartphones shortly. So really, foundationally, our objective is to give consumers the ability to choose the food that's most nutritious for them and their families, and use that economic leverage to inspire the supply chain writ large to focus on producing it. And so we are in a part of a really broad collaboration of allies. Really, the handheld tool is just the hook to get people's attention. Systemically, we need to actually understand broadly what is quality and what's the spectrum of variation, so we can define sort of the app from the handheld. But much more systemically, a deep analysis of what are the causal factors. There's so many streams of thought and recommendations and books and, you know, just communities in this broader movement. And when you're dealing with living systems, they are really, they're multifactor by nature. And so a lot of agronomic research, a lot of published literature is single factor analysis. Let's add more calcium and see what happens. Let's take out some potassium and see what happens. And when you're dealing with living systems, you have to look at all the factors in relationship to each other. So foundationally, you know, being able to assess, you know, and look at in relationship to itself, the soil type, the fertility program, the management practice, the epigenetics, the microbiome, cultivars, the yields, the pest and disease resistance, the nutrient levels, really being able to tease out which causal factors are most important for any given grower. We expect people to support growers in real time, again, globally, in pest management practices, so it can really drive this solution home.
Let me just interpret that a little bit for listeners. Yeah, you know, it basically what you're saying, if I have it correctly, is that it's kind of a two-way tool. On the one hand, a consumer can use it, and it's a way to make better choices when you're buying food. On the other hand, the data that is gathered through putting all of this together also makes it useful to growers so that they get feedback about, you know, as it were, you know, it creates endless experiments to determine which inputs and which practices and which processes are, you know, the most critical ones to make food, you know, grow food that's healthier. and that has, you know, better environmental sustainability. You know, in other words, that is also part of what's being looked at and tested. But the difference is that in general, in our time, and this is like a central theme of everything I ever write about or report on, we have all of these technologies and we're conducting experiments all the time. And in fact, human beings and all living systems on Earth are part of a giant experiment. Can we do this? And how will it affect, push it this way or push it that way? What will doing this one activity, fracking or, using a lot of nitrogen or whatever,
exactly,
what will that do? To people, to the produce and the other things that we're, so we're living in an experiment. The difference here is that this is a conscious experiment that regards, you know, human health, biological diversity and health, and planetary health as, you know, the desired outcomes that it will drive toward and select for, rather than exclusively a profit orientation with a neglectful attitude and a lack of scientific curiosity, in fact, or scientific research in many cases, toward, you know, what are the outcomes of these experiments going to be on various forms of life. So, you know, the thing that I find so outstanding about this is that now there's an opportunity and a group of people come together to conduct these experiments with the right values, for the sake of the right things, you know, the things that really sustain life. So I just, want to mention, go ahead.
No, just one piece on that is that I didn't say before, but foundationally, everything we're working on is open source. The handheld tool is open source. The data sets for, you know, describing and the variation in quality is open source. The platform for farm management and data collection is open source. This is being held entirely in the commons. We are an educational nonprofit organization, and we're working with partners who are not working from a monetary, agenda primarily. We are not taking investment. We're not selling shares. This is entirely non-proprietary. Everything we're doing here is in the commons, and that's our foundational incentive, which I think you're referring to, is that you know, through this collaborative, empirical, open process, we can, you know, hold space for a coalition to, coalesce to convene, which really is foundationally biological. It's foundationally, mycorrhizal. It's networked. It's symbiotic. It's not top down. It's not reductionist. It's not sort of fascist and, you know, whatever other words you want to use. It's a framework for interaction which is foundationally different than a lot of the current cultural milieu. So our idea is if we hold space for this collaboration and people engage and money begins to move, then we simply are, you know, standing up the alternate reality, you know, from a foundational structure. Mm. So
well, you're actually more grand foundational reality. Mm-hmm. You're copying nature. Your structure is copying nature. It's mimicking.
Exactly.
It's basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's basing. You're doing your process and designing it to take the best of what nature does. You know, rather than imposing upon nature and then thinking that out of the brilliant mind of, you know, humankind, something better will necessarily come when we kind of diss nature in some sort of way. I just want to mention to anyone listening who feels a call, feels a tug, feels a pull, when you hear this, as I know I did, to come to the conference, if that's possible for you. It's called the Soil and Nutrition Conference. It's the 7th annual such conference. It's occurring in Southbridge, Massachusetts, November 29th through 30th, 2017. What a great thing happening the week after Thanksgiving to give back to the earth and celebrate, you know, whatever harvest, we've enjoyed, the Native American peoples have welcomed us to this beautiful land to honor that gift and express our gratitude and say thanks, through attending the conference, Growing the Movement Around Food Quality, Soil and Nutrition Conference. And you can find out more information online at bionutrient.org. Bionutrient, which is spelled bionutrient.org. So we're talking again with Dan Kittredge, who is the founder and executive director of this organization. And Dan, you'll also be speaking at the conference. Let's talk a little bit about the conference and who's going to be attending and speaking.
As you said, this is our seventh annual conference, and as someone who had been going to organic conferences for decades, finding a lot of the content really hadn't evolved too much, and finding that there's all these other interesting pieces, more broadly. I'll go to this conference over here and find this conversation, go to that conference over there and find that conversation. our thought was that we have all these different organizations and networks doing really wonderful work and sort of bringing people in from the bottom up and educating them and empowering them. But there's a larger conversation when we begin to integrate those conversations. And so, our conference, soil and nutrition, has been historically primarily for the growers, from backyard gardeners to, homesteaders to farmers. So the majority of our workshops have something to do with agriculture, but certainly significant quotients on human health, nutrition. We go to epigenetics and the microbiome. We talk about, coherence and structure and intention and quantum mechanics. We talk about, it's a broader conversation, integrating biodynamics, integrating permaculture, integrating all the regenerative practices, looking at, the social movements that are going on agriculturally, globally, and
let
the implications of them. It's a broad cross-section of people, active, engaged consumers, nutritionists, chefs, growers of all sorts, organizational people, foundations. It's a really nice group of people. It's always a really nice.
It sounds
vibe.
Like a great group of people.
Can you let our listeners know
a little bit about what regenerative agriculture means, or regenerative organic agriculture? Because this is a new term. It's very well known in the circles that we're talking about today, but it may not be, what it actually means. I think many listeners really could benefit from an orientation of, what that's about, because it's sometimes described as, the sort of next step, next phase. What does it mean, regenerative agriculture?
Yeah. I think it's one of these next conversations that's coming up. I've watched permaculture come up, and the local wars, and there's the slow food, and there's the Weston Price, and there's all these sort of impulses that have come up in the past couple of decades of people trying to focus on one aspect and sort of integrate that into the broader conversation. And here's something that's been integrated. So the regenerative piece is sort of it's a broad sort of restructuring of sustainable. Do we want a sustainable level of vitality, or do we want to systemically regenerate? And so that's one of the framing points. But it is primarily people interested in the aspect of carbon sequestration through agriculture. It's primarily sort of a integration of the the broader industry and their global warming climate goals and sort of focusing on how do we sequester carbon in agriculture. I think one piece of this conversation is the understanding that through agriculture done well, we have the capacity to systemically sequester carbon in the atmosphere at a rate that will potentially bring us back to pre-industrial revolution levels, in our lifetimes, in a generation, I say it, you know, not just, you know, keep carbon from going past 450 parts per million in the atmosphere, where it's 400 now, but bring it back to 280 where it was in 1750. We have the ability through agriculture done well to sequester all the carbon from the atmosphere we need to rebalance the ecosystem in that manner.
That's an astounding statement. Okay, let me just ask, you know, again for the listeners who may not be familiar with every one of these terms. You know, what does it mean, sequester carbon? Like, what happens there?
Yeah.
You're saying that agriculture can actually reverse direction on the devolutionary trajectory of the planet cooking, which, you know, we're now going toward at rapid rate. And you're saying that the correct, a certain kind of well-done regenerative food growing can turn that around. How does that actually happen?
Yeah, and just before I answer that question directly, just as powerful it would be for human health and reversing the epidemic levels of degenerative disease.
Yes.
If we do agriculture well, we solve these problems systemically. So, on the environment side, you know, what I've been doing on farming professionally for the past 10 years is traveling the country and the continent, really, you know, giving deep dive courses to growers in best practices and principles and rationales. And, you know, I start off the conversation saying most plants are green. And I was like, yep. Okay. I'm like, why are they green? Well, they, you know, the chlorophyll, right? Yeah. So they cover their bodies in the chlorophyll, the chloroplasts. What happens there? Photosynthesis. The, you know, process of photosynthesis is sort of, you know, water and carbon dioxide and sunlight are the inputs, and sugar and oxygen are the outputs. And the oxygen is injected out of the leaves into the atmosphere. That's what we breathe. And in nature, healthy plants inject a majority of the sugar into the soil, from the leaves down through the, you know, stems, branches, you know, into the roots and literally into the soil. So plants cover themselves in green to manufacture oxygen and sugar, which they then inject into the environment. Now, the reason that plants inject sugar into the soil is because it was a long time after creation before God invented fertilizer. You know, in nature, plants evolved the ability to feed themselves, and they do that through a critical symbiotic relationship with their gut flora, their microbiome, which is life in the soil, which is bacteria and fungi, which is the bottom of the food chain. And so it's really about foundationally revitalizing this planet, revitalizing ourselves has to do with our gut flora, right? That's the majority of the cells in our body by a large quantity the people, the bacteria and fungi. And only when our microbiome is healthy are we healthy. That's the foundation of Ayurveda. That's the foundation of biological agriculture, permaculture, organic, you know, biodynamics, et cetera, regenerative, you know, whatever the word is you want to use for it, polycultures, you know, agroforestry. It's really about the flourishing of the bottom of the food chain. And so the plants make sugar and inject it into the soil to feed the soil life, because the soil life are the ones that have the ability to digest the soil, to do the acids and bases, to soluble nutrients, to digest them from their crystalline form to a protoplasm form so that they can be food for the plant. So the plant makes sugar, injects it into the soil, feeds the soil life. Soil life, go about their merry lives, reproduce, digest the soil, feed the plants. The plants grow, they make more sugar, they inject it back into the soil. It's this beautiful, virtuous circle. And the process is a process of carbon sequestration. You're making sugar out of carbon dioxide and water and sunlight and injecting it into the soil. The reason that there were 40 feet of topsoil in Illinois when the colonists first came is, you know, 40 feet of topsoil, where did that come from? It came from the atmosphere.
Wow.
It came from the atmosphere,
yeah.
Right?
Wow.
So we've got, you know, to sort of cut to the chase, we've got farmers doing a good job on major acreage planet-wide, sequestering carbon at rates of, you know, as much as 1.5% organic matter per year, which is an exquisitely large amount of, of carbon. you know, a lot of conventionally farmed cropland, be it organic or otherwise, or conventional, you know, we'll have organic matter levels at between 0.5% and 1%. And we've got farmers that are adding 1.5% per year, going from, you know, 2% to I think 11% in 6 years, you know, year after year after year. So if you do the math on how much carbon was in the atmosphere that was sequestered into that acre in that year, and you do the math and you add up how many acres of agricultural land there are in this planet, right, which is billions, 10, 12, 14 billion, depending on who you're talking to, being able to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere at measurable levels and put it into the soil on an annual basis is totally plausible. So there were, I think, 280 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere in 1750, and there's roughly 400 now. So in the last 250 years, we've added 120 parts per million of CO2 from the, to the atmosphere. We have the general story is that that came from burning fossil fuels, burning coal, burning oil, et cetera. That's the general misunderstanding, when in actual fact, you know, 30 to 50, you know, plus percent actually came from burning soil. The process of tilling the ground, of plowing and, you know, adding chemicals, you know, functionally burns organic matter, converts organic matter in the soil into carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So agriculture has been one of the largest polluters, you know, causes of climate change, and it can be the largest reverser of climate change. So, you know, I throw the number around of 15 parts per million per year. So we're at 400 right now. We could be at 385 next year. We could be at 370 year after that if globally we practiced agriculture well. Now, most people find those numbers to be.
Let me just ask you a question.
Yeah.
How long, what kind of a ramp up in terms of acreage, et cetera, would be required, and, you know, over what kind of time frame? Because, you know, what you're describing here is like, it sounds like a miracle, a way that, you know, doing something incredibly positive and useful, namely feeding people healthier food, more people healthier food, which I just have to parenthetically say is, you know, one of the things that has always troubled me, you know, is that I've had the, you know, the good luck in life, the privilege or whatever, to be born in an economic situation where I have been able to make a priority throughout my adult life to eat organic food, you know, and I've been in a situation where there's a food co-op that I belong to and have belonged to for over 20 years, you know, where the cost of that food is, you know, lower than ordinary supermarket food because, you know, 17,000 people, I mean, they didn't begin that way on day one, but got together and made a commitment to work together in order to make this possible. And then, you know, farms grew and were supported and evolved to grow in order to grow the food that is feeding us. And so, you know, I've been part of that sort of cycle of cooperation and have had the good fortune and the privilege to be in the position to do that. And I've also become along the way a huge proponent of this for its health effects because I'm a longstanding health journalist, you know, and so that's super important. And at the same time, always there nagging at me is the, you know, the kind of worrying concern that this is only for privileged people. It's only for people who have the availability in their community, can afford it. It, you know, I'm really into the idea that if a, you know, kind of a well-off group can pioneer something and then it can be shared with everyone, you know, it's just like a win-win for that to happen. But if, you know, a group pioneers it and it stays with that group and it never extends to all the people and all the population, except, you know, exhorting people to kind of eat healthy food that they can't readily obtain or afford, to me that has always seemed cruel and unjust, you know, to lay that on people. It seems also that through, and, you know, so my biggest goal is let the healthy food be available and plentiful and accessible to everybody, you know, because, you know, I know the personal benefit of it. So, you know, what you're talking about, which is expanding acreage, you know, would make that possible. So it's not a matter of privilege. It's like kind of shared in the commons and a right and source of nourishment to, you know, all human beings. But at what rate, you know, can this acreage be, you know, kind of transitioned to make this incredible potential on all these different levels a reality?
At this point, with the capacity we have with communications and technology and science and, you know, the global sort of world extremely rapidly, this is our agenda. to facilitate this transformation as rapidly and broadly and openly as possible. And so that's why we're building this open data platform for farm management. That's why we're building the open science hardware for empirical assessment. That's why we're, drawing the connections between human health and crop quality and soil health, is because we understand that from a foundational standpoint, while people may be, compelled by the broader issues, they're generally driven by much more visceral issues. Maslow's hierarchy of needs is sort of the framework, where this is conveyed, but basically survival and, care for your immediate family is what drives most people. And so what we're saying to people is basically, if you simply eat the best food you can get your hands on efficiently, you not only heal yourself and your family, you heal the planet. And we're basically, the structure of what we're doing is such that we can integrate the grassroots movements globally. Our vision is that smallholders in South Asia and Central Africa will have the capacities to apply best management practices to systemically re-green the desertified areas of the planet, occupy the land. From a foundational standpoint, as a farmer, I can tell you categorically, your cost of production goes down, your profit goes up when your plants are healthier. Healthier plants are more productive. Healthier plants have better pest and disease resistance. Healthier plants, it's foundationally good business as a farmer to grow healthy plants. Your input needs, your fertilizer needs, your toxin needs, your cost of production go down. And so the model of agriculture that we have, broadly written, is one that's input heavy, driven by industry and not economically, really supportive to the grower. And what we're saying is that the growers have access to the best practices of information, and if the buyers are focusing on quality, then we have the pieces necessary for this transition to happen extremely rapidly. Foundationally, money is a driver. And so supporting consumers with the ability to test quality and then working with the, companies in the supply chain to help and, drive it, I think we can go extremely rapidly. A couple of years, we're well along the way. Just a small aside, I had a conversation with some, people fairly high up in Whole Foods a number of years ago about this whole idea of testing quality. And they're, of course, very well aware of the variation in quality in crops. And the basic message I got was that, we're not going to help you put this thing together, but when you do have it put together, please come tell us. Because when you're 2 years out from having a handheld tool that a consumer can use at point of purchase to test quality, please come tell us, because we'll give our growers 2 years to meet standard. So that's the idea here. Basically, right now we are 2 years out from having this, having a tool a consumer can use at point of purchase to test quality. And so let's all work together to move this process forward, and let that be part of the certification conversation, the regenerative certification, the organic certification, the biodynamic certification, all these process standards. Let's take the best practices, wisdom from all these different communities, and if we want to have labels, if we want to have certification systems, let's move up the bar. Let's hold a standard that's high. And if the USDA wants to move forward and have that be part of organic, we'd love to work with them. And if they don't, if they want to keep the standard sort of watered down, there's all kinds of other groups out there that are really interested in doing a good job. So the opportunity for collaboration, I think, is categorical. And the question is going to be who's going to move in which direction, with what speed, and how peacefully.
Wow, that's really amazing. That's really quite a vision. Very, very hopeful vision.
Well, that's only half. Just the other half is the human health. If I, talk about that just for a minute or two, that's only half of it. I said the other half is the human health side.
Mm-hmm.
It was what Hippocrates. People know the Hippocratic Oath. A lot of doctors, when they finish their 25 years of schooling, that's where the Hippocratic Oath. Hippocrates is considered to be the father of Western medicine. I understand it. There's three sort of basic tenets to the Hippocratic Oath, and some people are familiar with the first. First, do no harm.
First, do no harm.
And then let food be thy medicine.
Yes.
And finally, let me never be conned, tricked, or otherwise inspired to prescribe a poison. So, you can meditate on that for a second. First, do no harm. Cutting, slicing, burning, etc.
Say that really slowly, Dan. For us to meditate on it, I want you to say it for us a little bit slower, if you could. Just say that last one, because that's the least familiar of them.
Yeah, first, do no harm. So that means no cutting, slicing, burning, otherwise injuring. Then, let food be thy medicine. And finally, let me, the doctor, this is my oath I'm taking at the beginning of my practice, never be conned, tricked, or otherwise inspired to prescribe poison. No.
What I've heard is physician heal thyself. I think physician heal thyself is also in there somewhere, because the thing about physician heal thyself is there's many levels of healing thyself. As a physician, we can, and I've certainly worked with many fine doctors who recommend healthy food and have been leading, the kind of rise in consciousness about, how to eat healthily. But I think part of it also is healing thyself not as merely as an individual, but as, a member of, living systems here on the earth. So it's not just, yes, as you stated correctly, the most visceral thing is, how can I feed my family? How can I help and take care of my family? And that's a driving force. But there's also the thing beyond that, which is the understanding that when everyone is nurtured, we all are nurtured and we all benefit. So, physician heal thyself is both personal, but it's also communal. It's also collective. And, all of this is it is so incredibly true. One of the things that has broken my heart, because I do some, I have connection with indigenous communities and, people with health issues over the, I'm a health coach along with everything else and with my reporting, is to meet people and connect with people who are having different health problems, and then, they can't afford to get the healthy food that would help restore their health. And so I am just personally touched by this work so much, because of the process.
If I can just finish the point I was making, which was going to follow on to the let food be the medicine point, just to sort of tease that out a little bit.
Please.
I like to say, it's either junk or it's food, but it can't be both. We know that we are built of what we eat. I just do a bit of a deep dive for a second. I think we have enough time.
Yes, we do.
I think they say that there's roughly 10 trillion cells in the human body. Be that as it may, it's obviously not 10 trillion exactly, more or less. Something like 90% of them are microbial, are bacterial and fungal and viral and things like that. So, foundationally, to start with, we are an ecosystem. We're not an animal separate from nature. We are an ecosystem, as is the farm, as is a microclimate, as is the culture, as is the planet. It's an ecosystem. It's a series of organisms living in relationship to each other. So just let that be for now. But I like to say, if you were a car and your brake pads wore out, you're designed to have them taken out and new brake pads put in. If you're a car and your muffler wears out, you're designed to have the muffler taken out and a new muffler put in. That's a mechanical system, right? Mechanical systems are a series of parts to be replaced. But we are not mechanical systems. We are biological systems. We are designed to be continuously rebuilding ourselves. And so what that means is, on a daily basis, 4 billion of your cells, your oldest, junkiest, most worn out cells, are being disassembled. Any salvageable parts, kept and reused, and the rest is junked, out the rear end it goes. and 4 billion new cells are built. So eyeballs, gonads, liver, flesh, you know, bone, you know, we are constantly being rebuilt. It takes maybe just a couple of weeks for your blood to be, you know, thoroughly renewed. It might take 7 years for your bones to be renewed. But on average, you get a new body about every 6 months or so. So when the human genome project was being performed in the 90s, and they were documenting, you know, what are all the pieces of the human DNA, they didn't just identify what, you know, the pieces of the DNA were. They identified all the enzymes that were used to build that DNA. DNA is a big, long compound, and all the different pieces have to get put together. It's the enzymes in sort of biochemistry that are used to do that. They're like buckets or wrenches or screwdrivers. They have a unique size and shape, and they're used to put things together or take things apart. They're used over and over again. And what gives the enzymes the unique geometry, size, and shape is the element at their core. So there's copper-based enzymes and zinc-based enzymes and chromium-based enzymes, et cetera. So when the, you know, human genome project was being performed and they identified all enzymes necessary to replicate one kind of human DNA, they were then able to identify all of the elements at the core of those enzymes. And there are literally dozens of different elements required to build every strand of human DNA. Copper, zinc, manganese, boron, cobalt, molybdenum, selenium, you know, just you add how many elements can you name? Literally dozens of them are required 4 billion times a day just for basic bodily maintenance. And the point here is that when food is grown with, you know, NPK, nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, fertilizer, soluble nutrients in solution, IV drip, whether it's organic IV drip or conventional IV drip, and three or four or five elements are being, you know, attended to, what about the rest of them? If they're not in your food and your body is built of what you eat, then they're not in your body. So what happens when DNA is being replicated and the piece of DNA that's supposed to get, you know, put together by the chromium-based enzyme is unable to get put together because the chromium is not present, it wasn't in your food, then you have a break in your DNA. You have a genetic marker. And these genetic markers build up over time, and we've got now, you know, a couple generations easily of people eating food that did not have a full spectrum of nutrients in it. And so functionally, physiologically, we are degenerating. We're falling apart. The epidemic level of degenerative disease, you know, matches perfectly with the decrease in nutrient levels in crops. And there's a beautiful connection between flavor and aroma and nutritive value, right? 30% of our DNA is associated with the function of our nose and our tongue. Nature thinks it's really important for us to be able to smell and taste well because that's how we discern what's good for us and what's not. That animal instinct is still there with us. People attend to flavor and aroma with coffee and with wine and, you know, their drugs, as it were, but they don't necessarily attend to flavor and aroma with their food. Let food be thy medicine. Let food be thy medicine. A carrot that tastes rich and carroty is nutritionally entirely different than one that tastes bland or bitter. A tomato that has a rich tomatoey flavor is entirely different than one that, you know, looks like a tomato. The nutritional value, the variations in nutritive levels is in many cases thousands of percent variation in nutritive levels in crops based on how they're grown, which correlates directly with their health-giving attribute. So the basic point here is you get a new body every 6 months. Your child gets a new body every 6 months. Your husband, your wife, your parents get new bodies every 6 months. What they build their bodies out of, the food that they eat, determines their functional health. What happens when that chromium is reintroduced to the environment the next time that DNA is replicated is that chromium-based enzyme is there. And that genetic marker that's associated with diabetes fixes itself.
That's right.
It's no longer there. Let food be thy medicine. We have the ability through simply eating food that is flavorful to heal ourselves and our planet. That's simply all we need to do. We don't need to stop driving cars. We don't need to stop doing this and that, which is very difficult. We can simply choose how to spend our food dollars and systemically revitalize. It's exquisitely exciting. So I started that whole conversation off on the regenerative topic with carbon sequestration.
Well, it goes all the way through. About regenerative health, actually. What you're saying is we're regenerating the planet and we
we're regenerating ourselves and our health.
We're all the same.
Same means.
Bodies
yeah.
are our microcosm.
They're not
families
different.
Are our microcosm. It's the same
yes.
thing. We save the world by saving ourselves. You know, I mean, it is the most selfish and selfless thing. And in the case of eating food, it's pleasurable because it tastes good. And you have more energy and vitality. You know, I think all of these, you know, intransigent, apparently, issues with, you know, culturally, politically, economically, you know, educationally, you know, it's all deeply interrelated. And what's so exciting is, you know, how bad things are getting. You know, more and more people are becoming aware that something's wrong. And if we can coalesce around something as simple as eating food that tastes good, which I would say economically can outcompete conventional ag. The whole point about it being more economically advantageous for the farmer is that more and more farmers will start doing it. And simply because you have a better cost of production, the transition in the quality in the entire food supply will be upward. We can do this. We can totally do this.
Yeah, this is amazing, and we're kind of coming to the end of our time here. And, you know, parenthetically, as somebody who has covered climate change from, you know, the fossil fuel perspective, I don't think what you're describing is saying that we cannot move toward renewable energy and you know, these contaminating, toxic means of extraction that
of
are,
course,
you know,
of course,
poisoning
of course,
air
of
quality and water quality. In fact, we have to do them both. But what you're saying is that this is kind of the, you know, the forward moving step, and then we can that will make it easier to do these other things as well, because we, you know, will. For one thing, I mean, the other thing, the beauty of this, and we are really coming to the end of our time, is that, you know, we've been suffering and in pain from living with a devolving perspective, you know, a perspective that takes from the planet and doesn't give back, that takes from another person and doesn't give back. And, you know, whereas regeneration of the commons is just, it's kind of, it creates a positive, forward-going, creative, healing, natural cycle. I mean, and that's what this is based on. I just want to thank you so much, Dan Kittredge, for being with us today. This is such an inspiring vision. And just at the time when we were kind of shrugging our shoulders and saying, oh, my God, what is happening to our organic food, folks, you know, please check out bionutrient.org, Dan's organization, with the upcoming conference, Soil and Nutrition, happening 2 weeks, a week after Thanksgiving, November 29th through 30th, 2017 in Southbridge, Mass., an opportunity to learn more and meet the people who are making this happen for anyone who's feeling the call. Thank you so much again, Dan, for both the hard work that went into and the love and dedication that went into creating, thinking all of this through and, you know, learning through your relationship with the natural world and growing to develop with others this beautiful opportunity for us. And thank you for joining me here today to share that with our listeners on Connect the Dots. I'm going to personally attend this conference, wouldn't miss it for anything, and look forward to learning more and bringing more around in about this so more people can join. So thank you so much, Dan, for joining us today.
My pleasure. My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, listeners. Be prepared to hear more about this. Thank you for being with us today on Connect the Dots. We're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. You know, come back for next week's show. Check the archives for previous programs on food in our last month with Dave Chapman, Fred Kirschenman, Lisa Stokey. Also, we're just going to end with our usual greeting, which is, you know, till we meet again on the next edition of Connect the Dots, you know, stand tall, keep marching forward in loving connection with all our relations. And I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well.
Well, well, well.